Khan is a dance drama which is based on one of Thailand's national epics called Ramakien, which means Glory of Rama. It is a Thai version of the ancient Indian epic Ramayana, also influenced by the Vishnu Purana and the Hindu deity Hanuman. While the main story is similar to tales found in Buddhist literature, differences still prevail. Many other aspects were transported into Thai context, such as the clothes, weapons, topography, and elements of nature, which are described as being Thai in style. The theatrical art of Khan combines graceful movements, combat choreography, rituals, traditional music, narration, singing, and poetry. Equally notable are the exquisite Khan masks, jewelry, and embroidered costumes. The masks are considered sacred and are used to depict a variety of characters, including lords, ladies, ogres, and monkeys. Khan was initially a part of a sacred Brahmin ceremony to recount the glory of Lord Vishnu. Brahmanism is an ancient Aryan predecessor to Hinduism. In many ways, the Khan performances of the past were more like a mimed show, as actors could not speak through the masks. The graceful body language was full of meaning and emotions. Though performances today include more singing, narration, and music, the body language of Khan remains the most integral component of the art. An audience who is well versed in reading Khan gestures can tell what the characters are saying without having to hear the dialogues. In the past, there were no audiences, as everybody participated in the ceremony. Later on, the performances became focused on glorification of Lord Rama, the seventh avatar of Lord Vishnu, whose story was recounted in the epic Ramayana. In Thailand, the character of Lord Rama is closely associated with the monarchy. The Khan performance, therefore, was initially performed only for special occasions, such as royal cremations and ordinations, and the dance later became popular among the public and served as a source of entertainment. As Aryan influences from India spread to Southeast Asia, the story of Ramayana became popular among the ruling class. That said, Thailand is considered a Buddhist society, with over 90% of the population identifying as Theravada Buddhist. The name Theravada comes from the Pali word Theravada, which means doctrine of the elders. Theravada is a conservative branch of Buddhism that is considered the oldest existing school of Buddhism. Buddhism was introduced from India and Sri Lanka in the 3rd century BC and became the dominant religion by the 13th century. Theravada Buddhists believe their teachings come directly from the historical Buddha and are preserved in the Pali Canon. The Pali Canon is the only complete Buddhist canon written in Sanskrit, which as a written language was introduced into India by the Aryan migrations during the early 2nd millennium BC, or roughly 3800 years ago. And Gautama Buddha called himself an Aryan. His philosophy is called the Aryan Way. Thailand has retained its monarchy and escaped colonialism and communism, unlike other nations such as India and China, and therefore has managed to retain some of the authentic aspects of Aryan culture, including accurately depicting Gautama Buddha with blue eyes, as that is how he is described in Buddhist texts, as the ancient Aryan philosophy was disseminated to three quarters of Asia by blonde and red-headed missionaries, as can be seen in ancient caves along the Silk Road. One of Gautama's usual names was Sakyamuni, or Sage of the Shakyas. This and the evidence of the early texts suggest that he was born into the Shakya clan, a Scythian or Aryan community that was on the periphery, both geographically and culturally, of the Eastern Indian subcontinent in the 5th century BC, according to Dr. Christopher Beckwith, a distinguished professor in the Department of Central Eurasian Studies at Indiana University.
We were ready to go out and explore the sites of Bamiyan, a very famous city. In fact, and an area, the whole valley, the Golden Valley of Bamiyan, is noted for an entire mountain range that was used by the Buddhists as a sacred place in centuries past. And that whole series of mountains there has Buddhist caves in it. Religious priests came here, carved the caves, and when the Muslims came along, many of the caves were destroyed. In fact, the caves were used as residences, and the tar from the fire covered many of the paintings inside, and that sort of saved those paintings. They've been able to remove the tar deposits from the fires of the last few centuries, and they have found Buddhist paintings, some of them of great beauty and color, inside the caves. A tremendous Buddhist religious complex in this Bamiyan Valley. Here is the large Buddha. The large Buddha is 175 feet high, probably the biggest in all of the world. And here's what remains of it. The face was cut away many centuries ago when the Muslims took over this area. But there are Huddlin David at the bottom there to give you an idea of size. And you're looking up 175 feet. And above its head, above the head of this statue, we could see very unusual paintings. We were told it might be possible to go up there and see the paintings at close range.
To reach the head of the Buddha, you first climb up a little slope, which takes you halfway to your goal. Then you enter a series of caves they have discovered, which lead right to the head of the statue. And we'd like you to join us as we climb through the winding passages of the cliff, passing on the way Buddhist paintings which cover many of the walls and ceilings.
And this is done with our portable battery lights as we climb up and up. We're going to be up 175 feet through these caves as we head for the top of the Buddha.
We see the red beard and red hair. It's a shame that these figures have all been defaced by people of other faiths at some time in the past. But it's very easy to see what they looked like, and we can tell who they were. He's got the red beard, red hair parted in the middle. This donor has blonde hair and a long nose and an Indian caste mark, which we call a tikka. Mm-hmm. So he's a local person, the Tocharian, but wearing elements of costume that are Sasanian or Persian influenced, and has an Indian caste mark. So we see it's a combination of various traits.
Well, we climbed down again, all the way down this way, and had one last look at that magnificent big Buddha, 175 feet high, carved in these cliffs 1,500 years ago. We'll continue in just a few moments.
Almost 2,000 years ago, the world's largest statues of the Buddha were carved into the side of a mountain cliff. Deciding they were offensive to Islam, in 2001, Muslims destroyed them.
Despite the fact the giant statues were blown into oblivion, the Afghan government's ultimate aim is to one day rebuild them.
While it is unlikely that the current Taliban government of Afghanistan will ever rebuild the giant Buddha of Bamiyan, which in Farsi translates as the place of shining light, a wealthy Chinese couple, Jansen Hu and Leon Yu, temporarily brought the statues back to life with 3D projections, which, for a brief moment in time, reignited the splendor of the giant statues, which were a beacon of enlightenment to people of all races, religions, and nationalities that took inspiration from the ancient Aryan monuments, which Militan sought to erase from history. Unfortunately, Militan Muslims continue to erase history by raping and forcefully impregnating Yazidi girls in places like Syria to, quote, smash their blonde bloodline. The Yazidis self-identify as Aryan, and the phenotype of blonde hair and blue eyes is only present in 1-2% of the world's population, making them part of an endangered minority demographic whose ethnicity has been overtly targeted and whose ancient history is being erased and replaced.
The Yazidis are haunted by what happened to them. It is happening still, an attempt to destroy them as a people. They speak of mass killings and forced conversions. Perhaps most traumatic is the fate of their women and girls. Some 3,500 are still missing. A few escaped here. The day the so-called Islamic State arrived is remembered by 18-year-old Hanan.
There were 20 of them, with long beards and weapons. They said, "You're coming to Mosul." We refused. They hit us and dragged us to their cars. Some of us tried to commit suicide, so they took away anything we might use to kill ourselves. They said, "Yazidis are infidels. Now you will live as Muslims." They took many girls for sex. We did not know what happened to them later. They told us, "Forget the life you knew."
Happy and excited fighters in a video apparently from the Islamic State. Today is the slave market, God willing, says one. This may look like some kind of terrible joke, but prices for Yazidi women are discussed in detail. The fighter laughs and says, it costs more for a girl with blue eyes.
There was one 11-year-old girl. They beat her a lot. They gave her to one fighter and then to another one from Mosul. We heard that she killed herself later in Mosul.
The Yazidis say Islamic State sought to erase their culture, their religion, and their bloodline. People seem stunned. Some women returned pregnant. They don't talk about that here. There is shame and grief. There's nothing embarrassed or furtive about the Islamic State's use of captured women as sex slaves. In fact, it's even issued official guidance on the practice. Christians, Jews, and Yazidi women can all be captured, it says. It says a fighter can sleep with a virgin as soon as he's taken possession of her. As if that isn't bad enough, the document also says a fighter can sleep with a prepubescent girl, if he so chooses. Women can be bought, sold, traded as gifts. They can be disposed of as property if a fighter dies. It is a depraved and depressing document. These are the victims of slavery in the 21st century.
So with the additional steps I ordered last month, we're speeding up training of ISIL forces, including volunteers from Sunni tribes in Anbar province.
That said, one needs only to look to China for a forgotten or forbidden history, with its many 4,000-year-old red and blonde-haired Aryan mummies, as well as dozens of massive pyramids, rivaling in size those found in Egypt, whose ancient pharaohs were also primarily blonde and redheaded.
The Chinese government last few years have released these pictures. There's hundreds of pyramids in China. And the Chinese government actually got the farmers to farm on top of the pyramids so that they wouldn't be so apparent by satellite. And the reason why, so here's the poor farmer that got the job. The reason why they were doing that is because they didn't want the Western world to know about these pyramids. Why? Because the legends that comes with these pyramids is that the sun gods built them, and that the sun gods were blue-eyed, blonde-haired people. As far as the Chinese government looked at this, blonde-haired, blue-eyed people had to be Europeans. And the last thing they wanted was European people being responsible for some of the most ancient knowledge of the Chinese tradition. So they didn't want those pyramids to be known by the West. They did find the mummies of these blonde-haired, blue-eyed people in the high desert of China. Over 500 mummies were found. All very tall, absolutely not Asian people.
Following footage is from a Chinese temple in Bangkok, Thailand, outside of the reach of the communist Chinese regime. What do you notice about how the deities are depicted? Esoteric Buddhism is the mystical interpretation and practice of the belief system founded by Buddha 2,500 years ago, known by several names, but usually characterized by a personal relationship with the divine, or in some cases a spirit guide, higher self, or a deity who leads one to enlightenment. An initiate must first study with a master who shares writings, teachings, and knowledge not widely known, and often referred to as secret. The student masters various meditation techniques and studies the tantra, generally understood to mean woven together, often depicted as a male and female deity in sexual union, and involves a sacred act of orgasmic bliss to bypass the ego and achieve enlightenment by transcending dualistic perceptions as expressed in tantric texts. Sometimes shown as a hexagram, the symbolic joining of two opposing triangles, the sacred union is not meant to be a tool for hedonistic pleasures, but involves the combined discipline of male semen retention coupled with female climax, resulting in an amplification and circulation of chi or prana and spiritual liberation. In Buddhism, the masculine form is active and represents compassion. The female form is passive and represents wisdom. When united, they symbolize the union necessary to overcome the veils of Maya, the false duality. While not present in Thai art, in Buddhist temples of India, Nepal, and Tibet, the representation of the male and female in sexual embrace are components of perfect enlightenment. For Taoists, sex was not just about pleasing a man. The woman also had to be stimulated and pleased in order for there to be an energetic exchange and amplification. According to Sun Nu, a female advisor to the Yellow Emperor, if sex were performed in this manner, the woman would create more jing, the Chinese word for essence, and the man could more easily absorb the jing to increase his own qi, or life force. according to Ruanfang Fu, a Chinese physician and author, renowned for his extensive research into the relationship between Chinese culture and sexuality. Many of the ancient texts were dedicated explanations of how a man could use sex to extend his own life, increase vitality, courage, creativity, and spiritual integrity, but only through the absorption of the woman's vital energies. Some Taoists came to call the act of sex the battle of stealing and strengthening. Fang described this battle as, quote, "The ideal was for a man to defeat the enemy in the sexual battle by keeping himself under complete control so as not to emit semen, while at the same time exciting the woman until she reached orgasm and shed her yin essence, which was then absorbed by the man." Madame Helena Blavatsky, founder of the Theosophical Society, played a significant role in popularizing Buddhist ideas in the West. She was among the first Westerners to convert to Buddhism in Sri Lanka, which helped spread Buddhist practices and ideas in America and Europe. Blavatsky claimed to have spent time in Tibet, studying with adepts, which she described as custodians of a secret doctrine that predated and influenced Buddhism. She viewed Aryan Buddhism as part of a guarded, esoteric wisdom allegedly passed down since the time of Atlantis, promoting the idea that Buddhism, especially in its original form, contained teachings from an ancient, unified wisdom tradition, which has been symbolically encoded into the mystery teachings throughout the world, including Kabbalah. According to Blavatsky, quote, "The mysteries of the Jews were identical to those of the pagan Greeks, who took them from the Egyptians, who borrowed them in their turn from the Chaldeans, who got them from the Aryans, the Atlanteans, and so on."
The Aryan race is a concept. It's a Kabbalistic concept, despite the fact that it's perceived as white supremacist. It's basically rooted in Scottish Rite Freemasonry. That seems to be what the underlying core is. So Scottish Rite Freemasonry, the basis of its ideology is this concept of the Asian Kabbalah. So it's the idea that the Kabbalah didn't originate amongst the Jews. It originated before them, long before them, amongst the Aryans. And the Aryans lived on Atlantis, where they interbred with the sons of God of the Bible, or ancient aliens, as they're known popularly right now, extraterrestrials. Yeah. And they interbred with them and created a race, a superior race known as the Aryans. And to them, they taught the so-called ancient wisdom. When this is supposed to have taken place at the time of Genesis, the time of the flood. So the sinking of Atlantis is supposed to be the flood. The Aryans escape, land in the mountains of Asia, and from there they spread to various parts of the world, and they spread their ancient wisdom. One of the most important ones is, and this is what Blavatsky explained, is that the Aryans were responsible for the spread of Bon Shamanism, which is, she says, in her language, is that it's the true, the only true inheritance of the ancient Aryan tradition of magic, and that Bon Shamanism then feeds into Tibetan Buddhism, very mystical branch of Buddhism. And so that's the nature of that connection. When you look at especially right up until modern times, you look at the history of the Kabbalah, it's based on the belief that the sons of God, or the Anunnaki, the Anakim, were offspring of the sons of God and human beings. And so that this superior race, they're called in the Zohar, they're called, in fact, in the Bible, they're called the mixed multitude. And it's the Zohar that associates them with the sons of God. And so this mixed multitude is the Aryan race. So as paradoxical as it might seem, the whole concept of the Aryan race is actually a Kabbalistic myth of Jewish, you know, occult Jewish supremacy. And so it's the belief that they are semi-divine because they are offspring of the fallen angels.
And on the Christian side, these would be the i.e. sons of God, the descendants of these i.e. spirits and humans, right?
Yeah. And okay. More than that, it's basically the fundamental Kabbalistic belief is that the sons of God created a race of beings that, sorry, a race of superior humans who have been preserving the ancient wisdom ever since. Oliver Pike was a proponent of the of Aryan theories. He later became a member of the Theosophical Society, which of course is headed by Blavatsky, who was the most recent proponent or, you know, elaborator of the Aryan myth, the mythology that the Aryans are survivors of Atlantis, who are originally descendants of the sons of God, Anakim Anunnaki, who had preserved the ancient wisdom, quote-unquote Kabbalah, since that time.
And this went through, of course, through Judah, the tribe of Judah, and through the various prophets and so forth, right?
Well, this is where it gets strange, because this is where you have a simultaneously contradicting history, right? Like, really what happened is that the when the lost tribes get scattered, they get scattered to the land of the Medes in and all the way into Central Asia. And that's where supposedly they intermarried with the Scythians. And that's where they become the lost tribes, become the Turks. They become, they eventually migrate to Europe, where they become Scandinavians and Scots.
Sure. And that, then you had the Picts and the different, the Celts and so forth.
The Scandinavians, descendants of Odin, and the Vikings and the Scots, particularly in Isle of Orkney, which is where the Sinclairs come from. And that's where you get this heritage of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. The Aryans, the descendants of the Anakim become the Canaanites.
Sure. And of course we know the Canaanites are very industrious, right? They would bring business and trading all around the world through their boats and so forth.
Phoenicians. Yeah.
Phoenicians, correct.
So, you know, the some portion of the Jews likely fabricated these stories to claim this, you know, some kind of unique descent from gods or, you know, entities. But simultaneously, you have it's the lost tribes who are, you know, among the Scythians that are considered really the descendants or the Aryans, the source of the Aryan people. So you have the simultaneous history, which is weird. Why basically you've got, you know, it's a Jewish esoteric mythology which produced the Aryan race, while also that produced the Aryan race. So you have this dual path of, you know, this like legitimate Jewish descent, simultaneously this competing, opposing Aryan descent, but they seem to feed the same mythology.
Brothers or cousins, right? And then they're both masters of the horse, you know, and they literally conquered the world on the horse.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through Patreon or various links available in the description section. You can also click on the thanks tab below the video to leave a donation as part of a comment, or if you'd like to ask a question, and I will try my best to reply in a timely manner. I also appreciate any constructive feedback I get, suggestions on a future video topic, or if you just like to share your thoughts with the community. Please remember to subscribe, hit the notification bell, and check back often. Stay safe, and I hope to see you again soon.